Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
I'm going to go after progressive revenue.
The mayor says he won't propose new property taxes, but is looking for progressive ways to raise more revenue. Officials are planning to remove a homeless encampment on the city's north side after a fire breaks out. Advocates push back against cuts to gender-affirming care for transgender youth. A look at the local impact.
You know, I just wake up every morning and I think about helping the Cubs win.
And remembering Cubs legend Ryne Sandberg, who died yesterday after battling cancer. First off tonight, a homeless encampment along the North Shore Channel is being removed. It comes following a fire at the encampment yesterday that's reigniting safety concerns. Fire officials say there were no apparent injuries, but were unsure how many unhoused people were displaced. 39th Ward Alderwoman Samantha Nugent told residents in an email yesterday that the Park District will be moving forward with a closure of the encampment. The incident comes amid the Trump administration's new executive order directing state and local governments to crack down on the unhoused community. Joining us is Doug Schenkelberg, the executive director of Chicago Coalition to End Homelessness. Doug, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So fires are not uncommon in and around homeless encampments. So why are encampments more prone to fires?
You know, folks who are living in encampments are doing what they can to survive. And so, you know, they might be cooking outside, they might, you know, be trying to stay warm. Obviously this time of year isn't the case of that. But there's a lot of different reasons why fires might start. We don't know what happened at this encampment, but it is a safety issue.
And sometimes we don't know that this was related necessarily in this instance, but sometimes propane tanks are found at homeless encampments for use, like you said, keeping warm, cooking foods. Yeah. In a statement, the city said it is planning a more comprehensive cleaning of the encampment. What does that mean? And what does that mean for the people who are living there?
So, you know, I don't want to speak on behalf of the city. What we've seen in the past when they talk about comprehensive cleanings, it means coming in with heavy equipment, coming in to remove unused tents, debris, things like that. We hope that they keep with what they've done in the past, which is allow people to move back after that cleaning is done. We hope to have a conversation with the city about what specifically their plans are.
And we did invite the city for this conversation tonight as well. And like you said, typically in the past, the city has said it's a matter of public health and public safety that those areas need to be clean. But of course, there are concerns for the folks who live there being able to come back and also not losing all of their belongings.
Exactly. Right.
The Chicago Coalition to End Homelessness, you all, of course, you help to house displaced residents. Mm-hmm. It's part of your work. Considering what we know about the housing shortage in this city, how do you do that? How are you getting people into housing?
So it's really difficult right now. The number of people experiencing homelessness in our city is incredibly high and keeps growing. The latest point in time count showed that there was a 38% increase in the number of people who are experiencing homelessness, and that's looking at people in shelters and who are unsheltered, and that's on top of a 25% increase last year. So we see the demand continuing to grow and the supply not growing. There's real draconian threats to the existing housing funding. So right now we're in a really tough spot, whether it's the city, the state, or the federal government.
25% last year, 38% this year. What do you think is causing that increase?
I think the fundamental thing is that we don't have enough affordable housing. Homelessness is a housing problem. And between stagnant wages and unaffordable housing, many people are 1 to 2 paychecks away from experiencing homelessness. And that's what we're seeing in terms of this growth.
So last week, President Donald Trump, he signed an executive order called Ending Crime and Disorder on America's Streets, which, among other things, it seeks to revive, quote, civil commitment, or that's the process of placing individuals with mental health issues in treatment without their consent. Your organization has denounced this executive order. Why do you oppose it?
It is absolutely what we should not be doing when it comes to homelessness. It turns its back on the best practices that we know work. Models like Housing First or Harm Reduction, which are incredibly effective at moving people from experiencing homelessness to being stably housed and remaining stably housed. It removes people's rights. We shouldn't be involuntary in committing anyone to institutions. You know, struggling with mental health issues, struggling with substance use issues, that is something we see throughout our society, and we shouldn't be treating people experiencing homelessness as though that they're a pariah because they're dealing with those issues. What we should be doing, what this administration should be doing, is focusing on best practices, on creating more housing opportunities that get people out of homelessness and keep them out.
Who would most likely be affected, or who's most likely to be most affected by an order like this one?
Well, you know, depending on how things play out, and we don't know, you know, I suspect that there's an opportunity to pose legal challenges to the order. It's not really sure how you actually implement a lot of the pieces of this order. But, you know, it's individuals who are unsheltered, who are at risk of, you know, summarily being removed from the streets, not because they're going to be getting housing, but being they want to be take them out of the line of sight.
Are people of color more likely to
absolutely
be disproportionately impacted?
Yeah, people of color. You know, what we see in Chicago is roughly 70% of the people experiencing homelessness are black, while they make up about 29% of the population overall. So there's a huge mismatch there. Whole host of marginalized groups that this administration has gone after are disproportionately impacted by homelessness, be they immigrants, be they the LGBTQ community, be it black and brown folks. They're all being hit even harder with this executive order.
This order would also shift funding away from housing first practices like the ones being used in Chicago. What do we know about those and how they work?
What they do is they meet people where they're at. They recognize that the ability to address the issues that people are dealing with, whether it's mental health, whether it's chronic health issues, whether it's substance use issues, those things are much easier to deal with when someone's stably housed. So you don't put conditions on people moving into housing. You get them into permanent housing, and then you provide them the services they need to address that whole host of issues. It works. It has been studied ad nauseum. It shows that people stay housed when they get that. So the types of barriers that the Trump administration is trying to put up, trying to require sobriety before you have access to housing, to require using medications before you have access to housing, is the exact wrong way for us to be going, and it's ineffective.
Yesterday, we reported that residents living near the encampment in housing had long-running concerns about the encampment in Legion Park. Some mentioned feeling unsafe because of drug use in the area, the occurrence of fires, littering, other nuisances or dangers. What do you say to those residents?
So, you know, I'm not going to speak to their experiences or, you know, try to refute their experiences. What I will say is I hope that, you know, they will see what we see, which is that the way that we address this issue, the way that we help people move out of encampments, reduce encampments, is more housing, and that they we can work with them to advocate for an increase of housing supply, increase of services, because that's really the only way that we're going to move ourselves out of homelessness, that we're going to see the elimination of encampments, is by really investing in the true solutions rather than these punitive solutions that the Trump administration is suggesting.
Okay. Doug Schenkelberg, the executive director of the Chicago Coalition to End Homelessness, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Up next, Mayor Johnson considers raising taxes on large companies to fill the city's projected deficit. Heather Chiron joins us next to explain what's on the table.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Chicago officials are considering hiking taxes on the city's biggest corporations to help fill the projected billion-dollar deficit the city is facing next year. Here's Mayor Brandon Johnson explaining how he plans to propose filling the massive budget gap.
So I think it's important that we look at, in a very meaningful way, you know, how those individuals with means, particularly our billionaires and ultra-rich who have benefited from a growing economy, can put more skin in the game.
Our Heather Chiron joins us now with more. Heather, so the mayor said today that all options have to be on the table to fill the city's budget gap, but he's already ruled out one specific tax increase, correct?
Right. Just a few days ago, he told reporters he would not propose a property tax increase. Now, that was a little bit surprising because property taxes are the city's biggest source of revenue, and it is the source of revenue that the city has most control over. Most other tax increases that people have floated over the years require state approval, with one big exception. The city has the ability to tax corporations, which is why this is an especially attractive option this year.
And what kind of corporate tax increases is the mayor considering?
Well, there are two proposals on the table. One would restore a $4 per employee tax that was in place for 40 years until 2011 and Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He axed it, saying it was a job killer. The other proposal is more complicated and is based on a Seattle tax that basically taxes the most biggest companies that have the best paid employees in an attempt to shrink the wealth gap between executives and their employees.
So what would that proposal have the support of the business community?
Absolutely not. Chicago's business community would see this as a full frontal attack on their ability to make money in Chicago. And they are certain to say that not only would it kill jobs, but it would also cause corporations to flee Chicago and put an end to sort of the steady drumbeat of corporations moving to Chicago from elsewhere. There's no doubt that they would use it to attack Mayor Johnson, who's expected to run for re-election in 2027, and his allies on the city council.
So when does the mayor have to have his budget proposal in place?
There are two key dates coming up. By the end of August, the mayor has to tell us exactly how big the city's budget deficit is. Is it $1 billion? Is it more? Perhaps it's a little less? We don't really know yet. By mid-October, he's got to tell us how he's going to fill that gap, and that's when the rubber really meets the road with the city council.
Okay, and of course, we all remember that budget season last year. I know the mayor and his team are hoping to avoid that again. Heather Sharoon, thank you.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Heather's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. Some local hospitals that have been on the forefront of providing gender-affirming care to patients under the age of 19 have pulled back on those services. Lurie Children's Hospital announced in February they were no longer providing surgery for patients younger than 19. Rush University Hospital and UChicago Medicine have also said they will cut some services for youth. This move comes after President Trump signed an executive order seeking to stop federal support for gender-affirming care for young people. Joining us to discuss the local impact are Shannon Parker, CEO of Brave Space Alliance, an LGBTQ plus center on the South Side, as well as interim CEO of Equality Illinois, and Rach Washart, a student at Northwestern's Feinberg School of Medicine. We did also reach out to these hospitals. We received a response from one of them. We'll share that in just a moment. Thanks to the both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rach, let's start with you, please. Give us an idea of the range of services that are impacted for these young people.
Yeah, so gender-affirming care is a very broad term, but I think what is being targeted right now specifically relates to both medication and surgical care. So in terms of medication, there are a variety of different things that prescribers use, namely puberty blockers, which can pause puberty, allow a young person to, you know, reflect on their own identity, make decisions without having to go through like the very distressing changes that can occur when you go through puberty in a body that doesn't align with your identity. So these are very reversible and can be used for kind of children as they're entering into puberty. For older teenagers, we can also prescribe hormone therapy, so think of like testosterone or estrogen, and these will induce more permanent changes to align their body with the gender that they view themselves as. In terms of surgical services, we're thinking mastectomies mainly for people under the age of 18. There's practically no other surgeries that are done on children.
On children under 18, of course. As adults, then we're talking much more complex surgeries that can happen later on.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it's important for minors with gender dysphoria to receive gender-affirming care?
Well, research has shown time and time again that access to this care is life-saving. Young people, especially young trans people, really struggle with mental health and have, you know, very high rates of anxiety and depression. And numerous studies have shown that access to gender-affirming care, whether that's hormones, surgical, or even just a social support network of providers, can really reduce those rates and reduce the levels of suicidal intention, self-harm, and really some other like adverse mental health outcomes.
Shannon, what does this mean for the young people who had previously relied on these hospitals for the care they were getting?
You know, what it means is for the young people who relied on that care, but also the families, it means that they're going to be left with a void of service provision. You know, in its most extreme and detrimental circumstance, it could mean that young people return back to black market treatments, right? It could mean that young people return to receiving harmful medications in an attempt to, you know, alleviate the dysphoria that they're experiencing. You know, it also means that young folks will have to potentially just turn to, again, unsafe means. But also what I will say, too, is that it means that the care providers who have provided care to these young people may also face repercussions, whether that looks like legal charges, whether that looks like the potential of imprisonment, fining, so many things, right? So right now, the young people, but also the care providers, are at a great deal of risk in this moment.
You're saying for the care providers, should they provide the care that...
That is absolutely right, okay. Yes.
We did get a statement, as I mentioned, from Rush University Medical Center, and they say, quote, Rush has paused on offering hormonal care to new patients under the age of 18. This decision was made in collaboration with our clinical leaders. Rush does not provide surgical treatment to patients under 18 years of age. Such surgeries for minors have not occurred at Rush since 2023. It goes on to say, our expert clinical team will provide more detailed information to patients and families based on their specific medical needs. Rush continues to be a strong advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. Shannon, what's your response to that?
Well, again, you know, the main thing that, the main point is that young people are going to find themselves without the care that they've been receiving for years, right? We're going to see young people who potentially self-harm. You know, we're going to see young people who have a reversal of the really positive health outcomes that they've been experiencing, you know, in previous years. And this is just really a huge setback for the young folks, but also for the families of young people who hospitals like Rush, University of Chicago have been providing care to.
Rach, there's been reporting that some young patients have had their appointments for services canceled at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. We did reach out to them, haven't received a response just yet. But what would it mean to patients that have already started care and have had their care to be halted? What would that mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's a devastating blow to anyone to, like, get your expectations up to have such an impactful, you know, procedure or medication and really to have that taken away from you. I don't speak on behalf of Northwestern Medicine, but I do know that, you know, hospitals are in a very difficult place right now, as Shannon mentioned. And I think that it's really just putting the strain on the families and the children who are going to suffer from this.
Many European countries, which have also been on the forefront of gender-affirming care for minors, they've also been pulling back, but more due to questions about the benefits and risks of such care. Rach, do you believe that there are any legitimate questions that are being raised, and what do you think are sort of the best ways to assess the benefits and the risk?
Yeah, I mean, I think with any medical intervention, there are questions and things that should be explored. I think the biggest concern for the European Union countries is just that we don't have long-term data on a lot of these medications, but there are lots of new medical advancements that we don't have long-term data on. So I think when we're thinking about whether or not to prescribe this medication for a patient, we're really weighing the acute mental distress that they might be in now, going through puberty in a body that doesn't align with who they are, versus long-term effects down the road that we might have, you know, new medical interventions to treat. So I think that there's some caution in the EU because of that lack of long-term data, but really what they're emphasizing is to take a more personal, holistic approach, which is what we already do here in the United States.
Shannon, universities, as we know, are facing similar choices, right? Either do what the Trump administration is asking of them or face losing billions of dollars in federal funding. Is there another way for hospitals, which also receive billions of dollars in federal funding in the form of Medicaid and Medicare, maybe research grants, is there some other way for them to respond to the administration? Because for some time, universities were doing what they could, and then some of them are finding themselves making a deal with the administration so that they can hang on to that money.
That is so hard, right? Is that this administration is literally using trans people as a bargaining chip, right? We in Illinois are fortunate, if you will, to be a safe state, right? But that being a safe state is only as good as the infrastructures within the state that can provide the supports that folks need. You know, so going back to your question, hospitals simply cannot last without Medicaid funding. But also, to the scores of other individuals who seek supports from hospitals, cancer supports, diabetes, all the other, the emergency supports. I mean, the hospitals, the communities, the patients simply would be devastated, right? So again, what a cruel moment that we're in when this administration is literally leveraging billions of dollars against hospitals, all in the name of providing safety, if you will, for trans people, which is the furthest thing that they're providing.
Rach, what's the alternative for families and the young people who had been or had hoped to receive care from these hospitals? Is out of country a realistic option?
I mean, I think that that really depends on the situation a family is in. I know that there are grassroots movements here in Illinois for providers who don't receive money from the federal government to come together and provide kind of emergency services for these people. But obviously, like, we're kind of at a critical moment where there are many young people kind of being left out in the dark with no access to these services. Mm-hmm. So I think that this might look like traveling to different states for people for whom that's financially accessible. And I think that really means the burden falls on those who didn't have any other options.
Okay, that's what we'll have to leave it. Shannon Parker and Rach Washart, thanks to you both for joining us. Best of luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, remembering Chicago Cubs legend, Ryne Sandberg. The 1984 season was a magical time for the Chicago Cubs. The team made the postseason for the first time in 39 years, eventually coming up one game short of the World Series. Ryne Sandberg, who died yesterday at 65, was in his third full major league season. 1984 was a breakout year for Sandberg, who was named National League MVP. Here he is on WTTW's sports show called Time Out, talking about his success with reporter Kenny McReynolds.
Basically know the pitchers in the league now, and you know, once you learn what they throw, then you, as a hitter, you can kind of go up there and expect what you're going to get as far as pitches goes. And you know, I just feel more relaxed because I've been in the major leagues for 2 years, and just the surroundings and the atmosphere, and getting used to being around these players, you know, just feel comfortable. And you know, I've had a lot of help this year from Jim Fry. He's helped me learn about hitting as far as thinking goes. And you know, so far that, you know, I've improved offensively, a big reason is Jim Fry.
Are you tired of all this media attention? Everywhere you go, the All-Star game, everybody wants to talk to Sandberg. Everywhere you go, media, writers, everybody wants to talk to you. Are you tired of all of this attention?
Not really. You know, it's part of the game. The media has to do their job and cover the games and everything. And I just try and take care of the media. And, you know, about an hour before the game, then I stop and I start thinking about the ball game and play the game. But, you know, if you don't do that and if you let them interfere with you and wreck your concentration on the game, then it can affect you on the field. But so far, you know, I've handled it okay. I feel comfortable doing it, and you know, I'm thinking about still playing good ball and helping the Cubs win.
I hate to put you on the spot, but there's no doubt that you're having an MVP year. A lot of people think you're the best player in the National League, and your stats show that, and the team standing show that. Do you think you're the MVP of the National League? And I don't want to put you on the spot.
It's tough to answer. I'm not thinking about anything like that. I'm not thinking about personal goals or awards or anything. I think that, you know, those things will come if they're deserved. And, you know, I just wake up every morning and I think about helping the Cubs win. And, you know, that's the way that I look at it. And, you know, as far as individual things, I just think that they'll take care of themselves if I play up to my capabilities, and all I'm thinking about is helping the team win right now.
And so far, Rhino, you've done that. The Cubs are doing fantastic, and a part of the reason, the big part, Ryan Sandberg.
Thank you very much.
Hall of Famer Ryan Sandberg back in 1984 on WTTW. The Cubs will wear a commemorative patch honoring Sandberg for the rest of the season. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. The interim superintendent on Chicago Public Schools on the district's budget challenges and the upcoming school year. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that contributes to public safety policy and guidelines.